Hello, and welcome to the Field Guides. I'm Bill, and I'm here with Steve. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Bill.
What we're going to do today, and over the course of many future episodes, is give you the experience of what it's like to be in the woods, in the field, and on the trail. Each month, we pick a natural history topic, research the science behind that topic, and then take you out to a natural spot and share with you everything that we've learned. And for today's topic, I bet that people at home can already tell what it's going to be about, because can you hear the beautiful bird song?
Yeah.
Steve is lying.
Yeah.
Because the bird song you're listening to right
is
now
is non-existent.
It is one of the few times that we're going to be adding sound effects in post-production.
Oh, okay. Okay. I see.
So Steve and I are not listening to any bird song right now.
Yeah.
We're actually at a site called the California Road Recreation Area. Mm-hmm. And it is a small patch, about 50 acres, of woods and mostly sports fields in Orchard Park, New York, about half an hour southeast of Buffalo. And today we're going to be focusing on the Dawn Chorus. And I think it's great that the first time I mentioned this to Steve, you seemed kind of confused about what I was talking about.
Oh, the Dawn Chorus?
Yeah.
I wasn't really thinking about it, you know?
So it's something that I'm betting a lot of our listeners haven't heard of. Now, I first heard about the Dawn Chorus when I came to work at a nature center a long time ago, back in the late 90s, and the director at the time, who was a serious birder, Dave Junkin, who I think we've had him on the podcast, haven't we?
We had Dave tell some stories on the podcast.
On our Christmas bird count.
Yeah, yes, I think it was a bonus episode.
That's right. So Dave told me that at the time they had a volunteer who would invite people to her place. Mm-hmm. Pre-dawn, they would serve them breakfast, have them sit in their hot tub, and listen to the Dawn Chorus.
Where is this person now? Because that's what I want to do.
They've passed away.
Sorry for bringing it up.
Nice job, Steve. So that was my first introduction to the Dawn Chorus. Now, if you're not sure what it is the daily pre-dawn outbreak of birdsong. So in temperate regions like where we are, it typically starts about 30 minutes to an hour before sunrise. Mm-hmm. And it's most noticeable in the springtime. Depending on where you are, it can run from March to July. We are recording right now. It's April 10th. We've had kind of a cold spring after a long winter. And the Dawn Chorus really has not gotten started. So I was out this morning early, pre-dawn. I'm just trying to hear what the Dawn Chorus might be like. And I heard a handful of species, but not many. But again, today is cold. It was below freezing when I woke up this morning here in Western New York.
You know, when I think of the Dawn Chorus, I actually specifically think about bird banding, because I'm not the kind of guy who's up super early normally.
Right.
But on the times that I've gone bird banding, like especially if I get there a little bit late, so you guys are already doing the rounds and I show up and there's nothing to do, I remember one of the first days that happened, I just sort of stood there. And the birds were going crazy, and it was like when I was first working on birding by ear. It was a challenge, but it was awesome to just stand there in the field, no one around to bother you, and just take in, like, try to identify as many birds as you can as they're calling. And they call like crazy at that time.
I'm going to talk about that momentarily.
Yeah.
The peak usually occurs in May and June, and the earliest species, they get going around what's called nautical twilight. So that's when the sun is about 12 degrees below the horizon, and just the first hints of light are visible.
The nautical horizon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nautical twilight, it's called.
So let's shorten it to naughty twilight.
Ooh. I like that phrase.
Yeah.
So those earliest species, they're followed in a rather orderly fashion. I put that in quotes. That was from the paper that I'm using for this.
A rather orderly. Yeah.
By lazier species until sometime around sunrise.
You're not putting quotes around lazy?
No. That was my input.
Yeah.
So the time of the first song is a species-specific trait. So different species, they start at different times, but many species do end up overlapping their songs, leading to what this paper's authors called a cacophonic chorus.
Jeez.
Like
cacophony?
Cacophony, yes.
Mixed with phonic?
Yeah. Cacophonic chorus.
Nice.
There's probably no other daily period that involves larger levels of sound complexity among animal group displays. So we're talking globally. It's so complex and intense, so many species going off at the same time,
oh,
as you said.
More than frogs, even.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, because frogs get, like when you go out for that first warm spring night where you're hoping to see some salamanders or whatever, it's it can be deafening.
It can, but yeah. you're not getting the variety of species, right?
I
and they're
see.
All kind of starting around the same time.
Okay.
You know, they're all kind of doing the same thing.
And with birds, it's like, it's chaos. But when, at least when you go out for those warm, wet nights for the amphibians,
yeah.
I think they're all like harmonizing.
Oh, right.
Which I feel makes it so much worse. With the birds, it's like every species going off, you know,
oh,
like
totally.
Wild. Yeah,
yeah, because those nights when those spring peepers are going, we could be standing just a few feet away from each other and have a hard time hearing
right.
each other.
Which I didn't do this year, by the way. Did you?
I did.
Was it good?
Oh, it was great.
Yeah, what'd you see?
It was good.
For the listeners, what'd you see?
So we went out for the salamander migration, that kind of first warm, rainy night this spring. So we saw spotted salamanders.
Mm-hmm.
We saw wood frogs.
Nice.
We saw green frogs. We saw...
Jeffersons?
Well, it's tough to say if they were Jeffersons or blue spotted. There's
okay.
that complex of salamanders. It's very hard to tell.
Okay.
Without knowing more than I know
right.
how to tell the difference in
yeah,
species.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was great. It was good.
Yeah.
All right, so what you were just talking about, though, the dawn chorus... I always think of it as my annual reminder of my ignorance.
Right.
There's always lots of species that I haven't heard in a long time.
A little bit less than a year, at least.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm always out there wondering, what was that bird? What was that bird I heard?
Right, right.
And I think I've told you before, what I've tried to start doing the past few years is early in the morning before I have to head off to school, I'll go out and just for a few minutes, I'll sit down on our patio, I'll set up Merlin to be recording and listening for species, but then at the same time, without looking at it, I'll be recording species myself.
Nice.
And then after a few minutes, I'll just compare, you know, what did I hear compared to what Merlin heard.
I see. I like it. It's got, like, you got Merlin, which is the answer key,
yeah.
and then you're taking the test. Yeah. I like it. Yeah.
And people out there, I understand that Merlin very often hears things that aren't there.
No.
So typically if there's a species on there that I'm like, I didn't hear that, and I don't know if they'd be around here at that time, I'll run Merlin through like three or four more times to see, is it still picking that up?
Just pileated woodpecker keeps coming up over and over and
right.
over again.
Or if it hears like, I don't know, like a yellowhammer, a Eurasian bird.
Like, right.
No, it's probably not there. So I've been wanting to do an episode on the dawn chorus for a while, but I honestly had no idea the can of worms that the research would open. I mean, I should have known by now, right?
Yeah.
But this is going to be a two-part episode, folks, so I'm just warning you now. We're going to do part one now, and then we're going to release part two in a month. But before we get into the bulk of the episode, I'm going to put down the umbrella we've been sitting under because it actually has stopped raining.
Yeah.
How do I close this, Steve?
Oh, push, the red yeah. button. The big red obvious button. All right, well, we're waiting for that umbrella to go down. I don't like what just happened now.
What was that?
Is that we opened the episode... as if Daniel doesn't exist. Because you're saying, oh, every month we do research and then we bring you out to a trail and tell you everything we learned. I was like, I don't do that. Daniel does that. And I just feel like we have to say, there's an elephant in the room right now, and that is, this is the first episode without Daniel.
Oh, just realize.
Wait, this is the first episode without Daniel? But actually, up until episode 66 or whatever, was all episodes without Daniel.
Right, okay.
And then we had Daniel for a little over a year. And now, this is the first one.
This is our first post-Daniel episode.
First post-Daniel episode, yeah.
But just realize that every time that you're talking, in my head, I'm just hearing, God, I miss Daniel.
Okay, I you know what? And that's fair. And because I miss Daniel, too. So
yes.
I just want to make sure that, everything has felt wrong up until now. And it's still going to feel wrong, but at least we cleared the air.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So, we have to get used to it.
Yeah.
It's reality. So, who studied the dawn chorus?
So, anywho.
moving on.
Yeah.
Who studied it first? I wanted to find out where research on this began.
Mm-hmm.
So, while birdsong is referenced in many ancient texts, the earliest written reference to the dawn chorus seems to be about 1,200 years ago. Believe it or not, it's in Chinese classical poetry from the Tang Dynasty. And Steve, when was that?
It sounds like 6,000 years before the Earth was even created, which is kind of wild to me. But
it was between 600 to 900 CE, so about 1,200 years ago.
Wait. Oh, 1,200. I was thinking, for some reason you said 1,200, and I was thinking 12,000. Yeah.
And Steve does math for a living.
I do biology for a living, all right.
Birdsong at dawn was a common motif in Chinese classical poetry. The oldest reference I could find was from poet Li Bai. And I wasn't going to necessarily put this in, but the name of his poem was Feelings on Awakening from Drunkenness on a Spring Day.
Wow.
I'm like, we
English is a lot older than I thought it was.
So listen to this poem, because I'm going to read the poem. Life is a dream. No need to stir. Remembering this, I'm drunk all day, lying helpless beside the porch, waking to see the deep garden. One bird calls among the flowers. Ask myself, what's the season? Song of the oriole and spring breezes, voice of beauty sadly moves me. Is there wine? Ah, fill the cup. Sing and watch the white moon rise until songs end and scent is gone.
Wow. Hold on.
What?
Who did you say the author was?
Poet Li Bai from the Tang Dynasty.
Okay, so they have orioles in China, right?
Apparently.
So.
I did not delve into the translation and
how accurate that was. But the fact that they went oriole with it, it must mean it's, you know. Yeah. It's got to be a close relative, I would assume.
Well, that's a big jump.
Unless it's like the robin, where it's like a misnamed bird. Because there's a true European robin.
Right.
And the robin we have here is, we call it the migrating turd,
yes.
Right? Because it's Turdus migratorius.
Right.
Or we also call it the red-breasted thrush, because the robin name...
it actually is a thrush.
Yeah. The robin name isn't quite right. Little factoid for you guys. But I was
little
saying,
aside.
Maybe it's not a real oriole, or not related to our orioles, but who knows?
Maybe Li Bai wasn't a birder.
I mean, he had no idea what he was talking about.
He was a chickadee.
He was drunk, apparently.
The bird wasn't even there.
Right. Yeah. All right. Moving on.
I couldn't locate who coined the term Don Chorus. But it seems to have gained prominence in the UK in the 1920s. It started to appear a lot in the literature.
I hope his name was Don Chorus. That would be
I'm
so good.
I'm going to name it after myself.
Yeah.
In terms of scientific study, there were some early studies, mostly observational, in the early 1900s. But things really got going in the 50s and 60s when the sound spectrograph was invented. Now, this is something that analyzed and created a visual graph of the frequency and intensity of sound over time.
Oh.
So think of Merlin when you look at those sound spectrographs.
Yeah.
This was initially used to analyze human speech patterns and improve telephone communication.
Hmm.
But it quickly became an invaluable tool in the study of acoustics, linguistics, and of course...
Linguini.
That too. Yeah. And of course, ornithology. Because for the first time, researchers could visually analyze and compare bird vocalizations.
Huh.
So William Thorpe was a British biologist and an ornithologist. He was one of the first researchers to use the sound spectrograph to study birdsong. He brought the first one to the UK, and his work sparked kind of this revolution in investigating birdsong. So throughout the 50s and 60s, he and others studied not just the dawn chorus, but bird communication in general, including how learning plays a role in birdsong development. Now, you might remember, we mentioned this in the Mockingbird episode about mimicry.
Yeah.
He was the first to systematically demonstrate a previously unknown fact, and this is something I learned in that episode, that bird calls are instinctual, but bird songs are learned.
Oh, okay.
All right, so it wasn't until the 50s and the 60s that was really demonstrated through the use of the sound spectrograph.
And just a note on Thorpe himself, I don't know, it's just bugging me. I feel like there's either something like Thorpe's Law or there's like Thorpe's J or something, or I'm just, for some reason, like Octothorpe is like, which is like a hashtag. I wonder if that's all it is, but we'll put it in the episode notes if there actually is like a Thorpe something. Thorpe's Law, Thorpe's
right.
Bird, whatever. Yeah.
So it's hard to overstate the impact of the sound spectrograph on modern bioacoustics. It's a fundamental tool in the study of animal communication.
Now, when it comes to those, do you think people can look at them and, like, music notes be like, oh, I know what that sounds like? Or it just gives you some basic version of the song?
I think, and I'm going off just my gut here, is that people that study this
could
look at a spectrograph and know.
Okay.
That's the call of a chickadee, or that's the song
okay.
of a chickadee. I mean... They're,
it's a language I don't know,
right.
in a way. So for all I know, it's that complex.
But from researchers all the way to you and me, we're using digital spectrographs, and they've replaced, obviously, the analog ones.
Mm-hmm.
But we all have them on our phones. We're using them all the time. And that's one of the pieces that Merlin uses to identify bird songs, is it uses that sound spectrograph, what it looks like.
I see. It records it, translates it into the spectrograph, and probably sees if that matches another... spectrograph or set of spectrographs from that species.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
All right, so that's some history, but let's cover a basic question. So, Steve, if you had to pick two big reasons why birds sing, what would they be?
Getting laid.
Okay.
And getting into fights over getting laid.
Very good. Attracting a mate and then territorial defense, right?
Yeah.
Those are the two biggies, but obviously, folks, there's...
get off my porch. That behavior...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Get off my lawn.
Because I'm trying to get laid. Yeah.
There are many, many reasons why birds are singing. Obviously, you can talk about social bonding, signaling danger, but those are the two biggies.
Danger, yeah.
There's a lot of research out there, and most of it tries to figure out why birds sing. But for this episode, we're asking, why do so many birds do it at the same time each morning during the breeding season? Why is there a dawn chorus and not a 10:45 chorus? Why not a brunch chorus or an elevensies chorus?
Right. Elevensies, yeah.
Now, I just got a shout out here. Remember the place we found in New York City when we went and recorded the Floriani episode?
Mm-hmm.
We found the place, unfortunately, it was closed, called Elevensies.
Oh,
and it was
like
that Hobbit-themed restaurant, which unfortunately we didn't get to go to. And I'm going to take a little detour here because once I started getting into this, a few general questions about the dawn chorus kept popping into my head, and I'm betting some listeners might be asking them too. There's three questions that I wanted to make sure I answered before we kind of get into the research behind the dawn chorus. Is the dawn chorus strictly seasonal, or is spring just the time that we notice it the most? Does it occur only in temperate regions, or can we hear it in other places? And if it occurs...
Oh, I have an answer.
What?
It happens at least in Western New York, and it happens in ancient China.
You're right.
At least two places.
Steve is connecting the dots. Very good.
Yeah. I'm just going based on things. The only thing you've mentioned so far, I'm just going off of. Yeah.
And the third question was, if it occurs in places where breeding occurs year-round, does it happen year-round?
So that's a good question.
What I found is in temperate regions like where we are, the dawn chorus is most vibrant and widespread during the spring when birds are actively defending territories and attracting mates. Now, while the chorus is most intense during the breeding season, it can continue into early summer, though the intensity and variety of the bird song may decrease as birds, they tend to focus then on raising the kids.
Right. So they're still doing it even after mating.
Yes, but the intensity usually goes down. It's not as diverse. Some birds, especially those that don't migrate, they may continue to sing at dawn, but just less frequently, even into the fall and even during the winter months. But it's never as cacophonic as it is during the spring.
They just like doing it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, I found out that the dawn chorus does occur in other regions. For example, in the tropics and the subtropics, the dawn chorus can be a daily event, but the intensity can vary, being more intense during periods of higher breeding activity. So, for example, after rains or during periods of abundant food, when birds are like, oh, we're doing well, we can focus on breeding.
Right.
And in these areas, other animals might also join the dawn chorus. Things like howler monkeys, tree frogs, insects, crocodilians, and even fish.
Oh, okay.
Fish participate in dawn choruses in some areas.
And as you know, I'm a fish guy now, so I'm glad you threw that in.
So you can look into that for the next episode.
Yeah.
And they're vocalizing for reasons similar to birds, but often for other reasons too. But this can definitely complicate matters for birds and for researchers looking into the dawn chorus, if they're trying to filter out all these other animals that are singing.
Yeah, now, like the fish and the crocodiles.
Yeah. Now, in the Arctic, during the summer months, there's 24-hour daylight, so obviously there's no true dawn.
Yeah, yeah.
But bird activity does peak during the warmer parts of the day, so that can create a chorus-like effect.
Hmm.
And now, that's in the Arctic. I'm going to mention the Antarctic right now, and Steve, I want you to put a pin in that and try to remember that for the end of the episode.
For the Antarctic at the end.
Just don't let me forget to talk about
that. I'll do my best.
Okay? Now, we should mention that where the dawn chorus does occur, there's often a second peak of singing at the end of the day. I mean, think about being in your yard in the springtime around sunset.
Mm-hmm.
There is a good amount of bird song, although it's less intense and dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this double peaked circadian pattern. And really, that's typical of many activity patterns across diverse taxa.
One of my childhood memories, it's one of those ones that, like, it's a memory of a general thing that I remember experiencing, is, like, those late day in the summer where just blue jays are going crazy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Is that part of the dusk chorus?
Sure.
That's what I'm wondering. Because those are what I remember hearing the most. Yeah. And it's not, like, an early morning thing that I'm thinking of.
All right, what are we hearing right now? Oh, my God, it just stopped. There you go.
Is that a cardinal?
That is a cardinal. Northern cardinal.
I'm not that rusty, all right?
But it's not dusk, so.
Yeah, it's Bill said afternoon when we got here.
He's just singing.
We're coming close to the evening.
All right, so let's get back to our main question. Why do birds do so much singing at dawn?
Do you want to walk while we
do this? Let's do it. So many studies attempt to explain the function of the dawn chorus, what they're singing about, without explaining why is it happening at dawn.
Yeah, that's very interesting to me.
Isn't it?
When you brought up that question, I was like, yeah, I guess I don't know why are they getting it out of the way early? Right. Like, I don't know.
Because there's a lot of studies that are looking at, well, this is maybe what's happening, but we want to get to the root of, well, why is it happening at this time?
Yeah.
So, and there's obviously going to be a lot of overlap over there.
And there's a lot of daylight left, you know what I mean? So, like, they didn't have to do it right away.
So in 1996, there was a comprehensive review of dawn chorus literature. They covered roughly 12 different hypotheses, kind of the 12 big ones. The latest and most comprehensive work that I could find was from 2020. It was a chapter in a textbook. It was called The Bird Dawn Chorus Revisited, and it was written by two Diegos, Diego Heal and Diego Lucia. I hope I said that right. Two ecologists from Madrid, Spain. So all the behaviors had an extra U in it. Right?
Did they talk about the colors at all?
That's right. Yeah. So they built on previous work, including that last big review from 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of boiled it down to the 9 leading hypotheses. And they based a lot of their work on studies published in the decades since 1996. Mm-hmm. So kind of updating what had been done previously. We're not going to cover all 9 hypotheses. I'm only going to cover a couple today, mm-hmm. and then a bunch more in part 2.
Yeah. Are any of them that they like to hang out with crepuscular animals?
No.
You know, let's just do it now.
Now, we can say with near certainty that just one hypothesis or even a few are not going to likely explain a phenomenon as complex and widespread as the dawn chorus. We just need to say that now. It's likely that numerous factors are at play, including ones no one has thought of yet.
Yeah.
And that there's going to be different forces at play for different species. But I find, like, the fun lies in exploring the ideas. It's more about enjoying the questions than the answers.
Yeah. I think they're avoiding ghosts, and these are actually the times of day that the ghosts don't come out.
Well,
we don't have a way to measure this right now.
And you also have to balance that with the fact that cardinals are, like, dead people coming back to visit you, right?
They are. And they're also, they're sneaking into people's ceilings and dropping like nickels or dimes on them.
Oh, I have heard about that.
Yeah, yeah. And it is the cardinals that are doing that, but
I'm sure some people out there are like, what are they talking about?
Maybe this is just local folklore or something. I don't know.
All right. So it's also important. I want to emphasize that the dawn chorus is a phenomenon that involves 2 levels of birds interacting.
So, 2 levels? Oh, a top and a bottom.
No. Because it can be kind of intuitive to think that specific birds are singing to communicate with members of their own species, and that is happening.
Sure.
But there also must be interactions between species, too.
Yeah.
There are some studies that tentatively suggest that certain species within the chorus may converge timing with other species as a way of competing among them or extracting information about those other species and individuals within those other species. All right, so we're going to get into the hypotheses now. Hypothesis 1. Dudes are manipulating female mating behavior around the breeding window.
Dudes?
Dudes.
Yeah, nice.
That's what I changed it to. Uh-huh. So, I don't know if you know this, female birds are typically fertile from a few days before they lay their first egg to a few days after. Mm. So, in one study, the duration of male song at dawn in the European great tit was closely connected to fertility of the male's own female.
Okay.
So the chorus of the male seemed to match the female's fertility.
Mm-hmm.
They started singing and then increased in duration in the female's fertile period, and then they shortened progressively until stopping altogether a week after the last egg was laid.
And for those who have never seen tits before, they're like, because we don't, right?
Right.
They're related to chickadees, Paridae or something.
And they look they are in Paridae. And they look just like a different, oh, who do we got here? We got a
killdeer.
Bird coming in over the water. Oh, killdeer just landed.
I didn't notice. Have I just forgotten that they're super yellow on their rump? Because that's super yellow
it
on
its... It did seem very yellow.
Like orangey almost. That's how it was so yellow, it was a different color altogether. Yeah.
You did forget that.
Very yellow-orange.
Yeah. And we're sure that's a killdeer.
I thought so, but I could be wrong.
He's not bobbing his tail, is he?
No.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's killdeer.
It looked killdeery to me.
Right.
So.
Right. Now, why would the bird be doing this? The study's author suggested that this might show the function of dawn singing was for two reasons. To protect paternity at a time when other males, what we call extra pair males, so a male outside this bonded pair,
yeah,
could approach fertile females, or it might be to increase female receptivity to copulations around this, by the singing male.
And let's face it, if you don't know this about birds, they're leaving the door open. You know what I mean?
They are.
Like, this is just a very normal thing for birds. It's like the male's just trying to stop the female from doing what she already wants to do.
Yep.
I guess, in birds, right?
She's trying to find the best male, right?
There's a lot of extra mating pairs or whatever.
It happens quite frequently.
Yeah.
People love to talk about, oh, this species of birds, they bond for life.
Right.
Maybe that's so, but there's a lot of side pieces going on, too.
Yeah, right. Like, I've heard there's, like, a distinction between, like, a social mate or something and then the extra. I'm getting all the words confused. But even where there is like a mate where it happens throughout their lifetime, they'll still seek things outside of that.
Right. Now, additional evidence has been shown for this in other species, including the eastern phoebe and the eastern kingbird. But it's not as simple as I just said, because in some species, yes, female fertility is indeed linked with longer or earlier singing around dawn by the males. But generally speaking, male birds sing around dawn before and after female fertility has stopped.
Oh, yeah, before and after.
Right.
Yeah.
So this...
Just as hard, or like you said before, lesser afterwards?
It's based on the species.
Okay.
There's no hard and fast rule for that.
Well, yeah, because this is something that I feel like it's going to keep coming up, where it's like, first we were talking about tits, right?
Yeah.
And then we were talking about, you said phoebes and
phoebes, which are... Phoebes and kingbirds.
Which are closely related species, right?
They're flycatchers.
Yeah, they're both flycatchers. And then I even know that there's some of the stuff out there is about wrens. I feel like there's going to be a lot of differences here. And we got to be careful when we're talking about different species to mention the species, I guess.
And that's why I said at the beginning, don't try to be looking for hard and fast rules that you can apply to the dawn chorus, because it's a mess out there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
So the fact that, generally speaking, male birds are singing at dawn before and after female fertility, it's suggesting that the behavior is not exclusively directed to the male's own partner.
Oh, okay? Yeah.
For example, in some chickadees, tits, and titmice, who you wisely knew were in Paridae, males sing longer at dawn, get this, when their female partners were experimentally removed.
Oh, like,
and then
ladies
right, but because then they stopped singing when they were put back.
Right, they knew to keep their mouths shut. Yeah.
I wasn't doing anything.
Yeah.
Other studies have also shown big differences between species whether males sing or not when their females are fertile. And in fact, there are a number of species where the dawn chorus seems to be completely unrelated to female fertility, including the American robin. Chipping sparrows, they don't sing at all until after their females are fertile.
Oh.
Why would that be?
Maybe they're worried about something that's going to kill their eggs or something.
No.
Oh, no. Maybe that's what they're doing is they're like, I've already got this on lock.
Right.
They're like, maybe I can get another something. Yeah, now I can get something else on lock. Maybe? Are they looking for something to spread their genetics even further?
You're on the right track. We know that in many species, females will cheat on their mates. And I put the cheat in quotes.
Sure.
To seek out extra pair copulations. And we know they often do it at dawn to escape their males guarding. Their males busy singing.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore, it makes sense for other males to put on a good show at this time.
Yeah.
This would help explain why in some species, males continue singing when their own partner is no longer fertile. So someone tested this, and this is a paper that I sent to you. Someone tested this by spiking male great tits with melatonin.
Yeah.
So they'd sleep longer.
Yeah, like this. So while they sleep in.
Right.
And then the ones that slept in, right, were the ones that less often they had their genes passed on to the eggs, right? Like they weren't the ones breeding with their female as much.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you remember the title of that?
It was like... You have it. I know you do. But it's something, it was like sleeping in, or the dangers of sleeping in.
Something to do with cuckoldry.
Yeah. Oh, and then, yes, the dangers of sleeping in, colon, and then there was a title of something about, like, they're more likely to be cuckolds.
Right.
Or something. Yeah. Did you send that to me because you're trying to send me signals? Is my second child who's about to be born not actually mine?
We'll see.
I guess, yeah.
But he doesn't have red hair.
She.
She, that's right. Yeah, I know nothing about it.
All right. Wow, this is very suspicious.
So I just loved the title of that. And the idea that, you know, those guys that sleep in longer, right, they don't get to have these extra pair offspring, right?
They're a deadbeat partner, let's face it. They don't deserve it.
So I have in my notes, the early bird gets the, well, how you doing? So we're actually going to get more into this in part two in hypothesis four. So
right.
I just want to reiterate what I said at the beginning introducing these hypotheses, that no one hypothesis is going to explain it all. Probably numerous factors are at play, all right? So when the dawn chorus is happening, at least for some species, it is tied to female fertility, but even for those species, that may not be all it's tied to. All right, so hypothesis two, this has to do with territorial defense and social dynamics. And before we get into the specific hypothesis, I'm going to share some general statements the authors made about social interactions, kind of an overview of these concepts that inform the hypothesis, mm-hmm, and that elements we should consider alongside it. And that's really how they broke up the paper, is for each hypothesis, they kind of had some broad general comments, and then they delve into the hypothesis. Mm. And I really feel they were trying to show that, look, we're focusing on 9 main hypotheses, but there's a whole lot of hypotheses out there, and a lot of them are related.
Yeah.
So remember that singing in birds does not serve one purpose. Think of yelling in humans. We yell for lots of different reasons, right?
Or let's say I'm just walking down a sidewalk, and just the way, just my gait, just the way I carry myself, like, not only is it intimidating the other men around me, but it's also drawing in the women around me. So it's like, sure, it's just me kind of like strutting my, I'm peacocking, let's face it. And it has multiple effects on different people.
Steve's a peacocking man child.
Yeah. So, that you know, and I illustrated it very nicely for everyone.
That's a great illustration. Thank you. Yeah. So we know that birds sing in multiple types of social interactions. They may be attracting a mate. There may be male-to-male countersinging. We often think of singing as just telling us about the bird that's singing. But this paper points out that when we listen to a bird singing, we could also potentially glean information about the intended target of the song.
Hmm.
So, for example, a bird sings one way to a female and one way to a male. They alter their song or their repertoire depending on the intended receiver.
Hmm.
So when looking at the dawn chorus, we can look at subtle characteristics like song matching. Is a bird changing its song to match the song of a bird that's nearby?
Hmm.
Are they overlapping on purpose when they're singing within their territory?
This makes me think of, like, you know when people play, like, a chickadee, like, mobbing call?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's a different kind of thing than just a chickadee going, chickadee-dee-dee,
right.
You know, like,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
We can use all that information to discover more info about who they're singing to specifically at dawn. Yeah. So there are several studies that have shown that dawn song is often sung at territory boundaries, suggesting that it's directed to neighboring territories.
Hmm.
So chestnut-sided warblers, for instance, they sing at territory borders at dawn, and they use unaccented songs, a very specific song. Songs mostly used in male-to-male interactions.
Hmm.
Studies in other species offer a different view. So in great tits and collared flycatchers, that's like a Eurasian bird, males sing at dawn near the nest. And in the case of a yellowhammer, a Eurasian bird, they sing in the center of their territory. So these species are likely singing to different targets rather than a male.
Okay.
Several studies have also shown that dawn song is particularly loud in some species. Chipping sparrows, their songs at dawn are shorter than songs later in the day, but they're also louder. And in the banded wren, they're louder and more complex, like songs used in antagonistic interactions.
Mm.
In chickadees, the levels of song matching are higher at dawn than at other times of the day. It's like they're paying more attention to what the other males are doing.
Are catbirds the Germans of the bird world, where they just, because they have so many songs, right? They're
right.
Singing a complexity of songs. And you were saying the more complex, the more, like, aggressive. And I'm just thinking, like, have you ever seen those memes where it's like, this word in English, this word in French, this word in Spanish, this word in German, and the German was the only one. Yeah, like, it just sounds really aggressive.
That means flower.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking catbirds are that, but in the bird world. Like, why is this guy so angry?
Oh, he's German.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have been noticing this, not about the Germans, but about birds and their songs, for as long as they've started systematically observing dawn songs. Now, in most species studied so far, Dawn songs do tend to be more complex and elaborate than daytime songs. And in 1913, an ornithologist noted that eastern kingbirds and eastern wood peewees used one song before sunrise.
Dude, what's up with these people in flycatchers?
I know, right?
It's like, this is what I'm wondering. Like, maybe if you looked at genetic work for plants, you'd be like, man, these people love mustards, like Arabidopsis thaliana. But now I'm wondering, like, is this a pet group of species or, a family that some researcher really likes and they're just really prolific? Or is there something about this group that's just really useful for studying them, you know?
And I would say you cannot use what I'm sharing as any kind of measure because, you know, I picked out certain things. And I'm like, ooh, that sounds good.
You're the one that likes...
Yes. There may be lots of other references to other species, and I just happen to pick these out.
Sure, sure.
So the researcher focused on the kingbird and the peewee, saying that their song before sunrise is one way, and that, quote, changes drastically after sunrise. So I'm going to play the eastern wood peewee.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear this.
All right. So this is just their normal daytime song.
Mm-hmm. Peewer.
Oh. Sounds like peewee.
Peewee.
Here it comes. Ready?
Peewer. Oh, that's the peewee again.
That's the peewee.
Peewee.
So, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen to the dawn song, and you'll hear how drastically it's changed.
Okay,
ready?
Let's see it. Oh, it's deeper. Whoa. Pee-wee.
So there's an extra Pee-wee. Phrase that gets added.
Yeah, it's like an extra syllable in there.
So they add what kind of sounds like an ah-da-dee.
Yeah, yeah.
After their pee-wee.
Mm-hmm,
here, we'll
mm-hmm.
play it again. There's a normal pee-wee.
Pee-wee.
And there's that added
Pee-wee.
Phrase.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
It may not, to listeners who may not be familiar with the peewee, they may like, well, that doesn't sound that drastically different.
At first, I thought it was just the same one, but a little deeper,
mm-hmm.
but then it went into that second
right.
part, yeah.
Into our ears, that may not sound like a big difference, but to a peewee.
Where that's all they know.
Right.
The littlest difference is everything.
That's a huge difference, right?
Yeah. It's a microaggression, let's face it.
The authors of this chapter, this was an interesting point. They did note that these differences in dawn song versus daytime song seem more common in bird species in the Americas, and that they could only find two European species where those differences were noted.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, and they didn't really get into explaining like why that is, but obviously that's an area
right.
that could be researched.
So it's just a phenomenon without an explanation
yeah.
right now, as far as we know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, to get into the specific hypothesis around territory defense and social dynamics, this was one of the first hypotheses proposed for the Dawn Chorus, and it's based on the idea that there should be a higher number of vacant territories in the morning than at other times of day because of overnight mortality.
Oh.
And that would increase territorial instability. So it would pay territorial birds to reinforce border defense at dawn since new males would be trying to settle into those territories.
Right.
Right?
New male cats.
What?
To kill them overnight. That's all I was saying.
All right. So, although territory turnover may be generally too low to explain the strength and ubiquity of the whole Dawn Chorus, like territory turnover, it's going to happen at night, but it probably is not massive. Some data do suggest that invasion rates around dawn are higher than later in the day. So males are trying to find new territories. Floaters in some species, those that don't have set up territories, are actively seeking territories at this time, perhaps because all the males are singing, so it's easier to detect vacant areas than later in the day. Hey, no one's singing over there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So let's go check it out.
Right.
Since no territories are taken up at night, there will always be a higher number of vacancies at dawn than at any other time of the day, even if mortality rate is constant throughout the day, right? Doesn't that make sense? Let me say it again.
Yeah, say it again.
Since no territories are taken up at night, no bird is going to move into a territory at night.
Okay.
There will always be a higher number of vacancies at dawn than at any other time of day, even if mortality rate is constant throughout the day.
Is it the vacancies that don't change, or is it...
It's because...
Them looking
night,
for vacancies.
Nobody's looking at night.
Okay, so the vacancies aren't the difference.
Right.
It's the...
Nobody's looking.
Yeah, it's the no one... Yeah, no one's buying.
Right?
Yeah.
Since nighttime represents a break from territory defense
Got it.
And signaling for most songbirds, This suggests actually an additional twist to the hypothesis, so stay with me here. Regardless of whether or not there are vacancies that appear, relationships among territory holders need to be continuously refreshed throughout the breeding season. This process is interrupted every night, and dawn would emerge as the first window of time to resettle hierarchies, territory borders, and dominance relationships.
And it's reset because these are diurnal species, not nocturnal species.
Exactly, right?
So there's like a, what would be the word, like a ceasefire every night.
There yeah. is. So the absence of communication each night could select for a renewal of exchanging information about things like resource holding, who's holding this resource, body condition.
This might be my favorite one so far.
Favorite what?
Theory.
Oh.
Or a hypothesis,
right.
Yeah.
Since the probability of a change is higher given the extent of time that has passed. You know, mm-hmm. you have this long stretch of time where the birds have not been communicating. So several sources of evidence support this idea. Firstly.
Oh, I love a non-expert having a pet hypothesis, though.
I think this one is the best one.
Yeah, let's go with this one, actually. Yeah.
So, firstly, mated males of many species, they show dawn song throughout the breeding season. Well after...
By the way, every time you say the dawn song, I can't help but thinking about that Cisco song, the thong song.
Oh. Yeah.
The best song of all time.
Oh, we should have altered that, so...
Let me see that dawn.
All right.
Let's go.
Backing up. Since most males of many species show dawn song throughout the breeding season.
This is a toxic episode, I'm realizing.
Well after female attraction and fertile periods, this suggests strong selection for signaling territory occupancy. It just makes sense. Secondly, we have seen before that in many species, dawn songs are particularly loud, aggressive, and directed at territory boundaries. And they're often associated with a high degree of countersinging and song matching between males. For instance, there was a detailed study of singing interactions in the banded wren, and that revealed a broad interactive network at that time, complex matching patterns among many birds. So lots of birds at many territories, mm-hmm. matching patterns. Now there's a third line of evidence coming from experimental manipulations of intruder presence. So birds coming into other birds' territory.
This sounds like the study you sent me.
Okay, and that led to changes in the dawn chorus the morning following the manipulation.
Yeah, they looked at two time scales. One was like a 6-minute time scale where they didn't really see differences, and the other one was that day and then the next day or the next morning, right?
So this was in Eurasian wrens.
I see.
What's the genus for wrens? Do you remember?
Oh, is this the troglodytes?
Very good. Yeah. And the Eurasian wren? It just repeats.
Troglodytes.
There you go.
Yeah.
They were exposed to a normal playback or a quote-unquote scary playback.
Right, yeah.
And it involved several changes in the loudspeaker position, so this simulated a particularly challenging intruder, right?
Yeah.
And the results showed that the wrens that had received the challenging playback, they started the next day to sing earlier at dawn, and they sang more and longer songs, so they were like, oh, crap. There's another male around. I better start showing off here. All right, so... I want to end the episode here, but just to do a quick recap, the hypotheses we've covered so far. The first one was all about fertility.
Mm-hmm.
Guys are trying to manipulate female behavior around the breeding window. So possibly, at least in some species, males are guarding against that extra pair paternity, other males coming in, or to increase the receptivity of their mate, or they could be those extra pair males trying to find a side piece.
Yeah, right? Okay, yeah.
To hustle in on someone who's already made it.
Yeah.
And then the second was all about territorial defense, that it just benefits birds to reinforce their border defense at dawn since they have that long gap over the nighttime. Now, humans celebrate, I'm going to wrap up with this a little bit, because this episode is going to come out in April of 2025. So if you're listening to this, when it comes out, you'll be able to go out and hear the dawn chorus if you're in a temperate area. Part two is probably not going to come out until sometime in May.
Mm-hmm.
Probably after International Dawn Chorus Day.
Oh, when's that?
That's on the first Sunday in May. This year, that's on May 4th.
Oh, that's usually when we do our birdathon, isn't it?
Usually the week after.
Okay. After that.
Yep, because International Migratory Bird Day is usually the week after.
Okay.
So humans celebrating the dawn chorus, it seems to be the biggest deal in the UK. I mentioned that at the beginning, and that's where this International Dawn Chorus Day started. And that's when people are just encouraged to rise early before dawn and listen to bird song. They have lots of organized events in the UK. The first was held at Moseley Bog in Birmingham, England in 1987. And the day has grown into a global celebration. It's observed in the United Kingdom, the US, even the Caribbean, and they say some parts of Antarctica.
Huh, the UK's reach is wide.
But the website for the International Dawn Chorus Day, they mention this, but I cannot find anything anywhere saying that there are events in Antarctica. And I am actually seeing lots of references that there isn't a dawn chorus that occurs in Antarctica. So in every reference I could find,
right,
seems to be on websites, seems just to be copying what the initial website says.
Oh.
Because it's always included in this list of how the celebration has grown to include these other areas, and right, even Antarctica.
It was the guy who wrote that actually took a trip to Antarctica, and he just so happened to celebrate. Right. He was the one guy celebrating.
Like, woo! Yeah. He's listening to the penguins.
Right, right.
Because, yeah, everything, anytime I looked up, like typing in specifically, is there a dawn chorus in Antarctica?
So this was the thing you wanted to put a pin in and come back,
yes,
to later? Okay.
Yes.
Like, is this the first Antarctica thing or the second Antarctica thing?
This was
it's
the callback.
The only Antarctica.
This is the
thing.
Pin. So if someone out there can find information on an actual celebration of the Dawn Chorus in Antarctica, I'd love to hear about it.
I hope we have some listeners from Antarctica.
All right. It's time to do our wrap up. So first, we want to give a shout out to Daniel. Of course, we already gave him a shout out at the beginning. But mm-hmm, I don't know if we mentioned that he got a job with Tropical Audubon, right?
I don't think we said so.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I don't think we said that.
That's where he is. So he's based in Florida, in Miami. And if you go to Tropical Audubon's website, we'll put a link. There's actually, he's already on the staff page. They have a nice little bio on
cool
him with a picture. I just saw a post of him on Instagram from Tropical Audubon. Him and one of their other higher-ups had traveled to Tallahassee to talk to lawmakers and celebrate what they're doing. He had on a suit and tie.
Whoa.
And yeah.
Wow.
He's getting all fancy.
That's cool.
I also want to thank our patron, Adam, who sent us an email after our last episode, the grass carp episode, because Steve, when you edited, you missed one final F-bomb.
Oh, I saw this. Yeah.
Yeah. So I went back in and bleeped that
you
out.
You bleeped it out.
I did.
Very nice.
And then we also want to give a shout out to one of our longtime supporters, the Hebranks.
Oh yeah.
Mr. Hebrank, he let us know. Do you remember in Daniel's crocodile episode, he talked about the one author or researcher, K-N-U-T was his name.
Okay.
We talked about this, and we weren't sure how to pronounce it. Is it Knut? Is it Knut?
This is what I'm going to guess, because I guess I wasn't thinking about the spelling. I know a Knut, so I could have probably answered
You're
this.
You're right.
But, yeah, Knut.
So
yeah,
it's a Norwegian name.
Okay.
Yeah. So thank you to the Hebranks for sharing that with us. All right, Steve, you want to do the thank the patrons here?
Yeah. So first and foremost, we'd like to thank our growing list of Patreon supporters. So thank you to our new patrons, Rachel, the drunk phytologist. Oh, wasn't she a patron a long time
ago? She was a patron a long time ago, and we should thank her because she made a very kind offer to give us a hand behind the scenes.
Whoa.
And I let her know, thank you so much. We have someone who works for us locally kind of behind the scenes. And
yeah,
we even have a hard time lining up work for her because our schedules are so chaotic.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but thank you, Rachel, and thank you for becoming a patron again.
Yeah. Maybe she should just take my place at this point. I'm like 9 days away from a second kid. No, I'm kidding. I love the field guides. I'm not going anywhere unless Bill kicks me out. Evan. So there are our other new patrons, Evan and Elizabeth P. Don't kick me out, Bill, please.
Yeah, I will.
We also like to give a special shout out each month to our top patrons. So stick around for the end of the episode to hear Bill's daughter, Violet, share the list. And if you'd like to support the podcast, consider becoming a patron of our show at patreon.com, or you can make a one-time donation through PayPal on our website. A big thank you to Emily F. for her generous donation in March. Yep. And don't forget that we have a Field Guides merch store available through our website at thefieldguidespodcast.com. And you can always help out by sharing our podcast with friends and family and by subscribing to us and leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps spread the word and allows us to reach a wider audience. We want to thank our newest iTunes reviewers, Prairie Dog, and also Eli Liana.
I think it's Ellie Liana.
And it's a Canadian review from back in November 2024.
So remember, a long time ago.
You have to switch the region or whatever?
The country on iTunes. And I just happened to look, and right, I saw that Ellie Liana had left us a review just a few months ago. So I wanted, right, to give them a shout out.
Got it. So come enjoy our sporadic posts on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky, and you can always email us ideas for episode topics, criticisms or stories of personal encounters with cuckoldry to thefieldguides@gmail.com.
And parents, remember to get your kids outside. Let them get muddy. Let them get dirty. Let them flip over rocks and logs and listen to the Dawn Chorus.
Yeah, and don't lose track of your partner either.
That's right. Yeah. And if you don't have kids, please make time to get yourself outside. So kids, we'll see you next month for part two.
See ya.
And here's Violet with this episode's top patrons.
Eric, Alyssa, Adam, Mary, Dr. Judy, Kimberly B., Peter R., Callie, Rich K., The Hebranks, Orange Julianne, Rachel the Drunk Phytologist, Daniel M., Diane, We Named the Dog Indy, Hot Dog Cold Weather, Dwayne H., Jennifer D., Jonathan A., Michaela, Vale, Andy W., Elizabeth P., Picasso 3, John R., Evan, Mark T., Cecilia, Julie B., Dennis, Chris N., Sung, Jeff S., Colin G., Jonathan K., Matt E., Plants in My Pants, Ryan R., Sophie S., Connor H., Measure and Principle, Fragaria Pepoloinoidea, Outside Chronicles, Andrew C., Quixote, Mark D., Max D., Melissa Marie in Dusty, Arizona, Kelly S., Sarah S., Helen A., Judy F., Ben C., Jane H., DoodleDude82, Gail and Mac, Kazis, Jeff S., Esther C., John W., Mark V., Bethany H., Rob M.
Mm-hmm. Well done. Violet is such a pro. She's been doing this so long. I accidentally cut off several names on the list, but she remembered enough to fill them in. So well done.
Thank you.
And patrons, thank you so much for your support. Steve and I truly appreciate it, and we will continue to do our best to bring you the best episodes we can. Thanks again.
Goodbye.